That fuzzy ball takes some fuzzy bounces, I tell him, and I can't control it all the time. But one thing I think maybe I can control is my body. At least, I could. Maybe, if I had the right information. Gil fills his 56-inch chest with air and then breathes out slowly. He says,
What's your schedule?
I'll be gone the next 5 weeks, summer hard courts, but when I get back, I'd really consider it an honor if we could work together.
All right, Gil says. We'll figure something out. Good luck on your road trip. I'll see you when you get back.
At the 1989 U.S. Open, I play Connors again in the quarters. It's the first 5-set win of my career after 5 straight losses. Somehow, it only earns me a new wave of criticism. I should have finished Connors off in 3. Someone claims to have heard me yelling to Philly in my box, I'm going to take him 5 sets and give him some pain. Mike Lupica, a columnist for the New York Daily News, points to my 19 unforced errors in the 3rd set and says, I carried Connors merely to prove that I was tough enough to go the distance. If they're not trashing me for losing on purpose, they're ragging me for the way I win. When I walk back into the gym, I see from Gil's face that he's been expecting me. We shake hands, the start of something. He walks me over to the weight racks and tells me that many of the exercises I've been doing are wrong, dead wrong, but the way I've been doing them is worse. I'm courting disaster. I'm going to hurt myself. He gives me a fast primer on the mechanics of the body, the physics and hydraulics and architecture of human anatomy. To know what your body wants, he says, to understand what it needs and what it doesn't, you need to be part engineer, part mathematician, part artist, part mystic. I don't fare well in lectures, but if all lectures were like Gill's, I'd still be in school. I soak up every fact, every insight, confident that I'll never forget a single word.
It's amazing, Gil says, how many fallacies there are about the human body, how little we know about our own bodies. For instance, guys do incline benches for their upper pecs. It's not an efficient use of time, he says. I haven't done an incline in 30 years. Is it possible that my chest would be bigger if I did inclines?
No, sir.
The step-ups you're doing, the exercises where you hold a heavy weight on your back as you walk upstairs, you're asking for a catastrophic injury. You're lucky you haven't already ruined your knee.
How so?
It's all about angles, Andre. At one angle, you're engaging your quad. Fine. Great. At another angle, you're engaging your knee, putting loads of pressure on that knee. Engage that knee too many times, it'll break off the engagement.
The best exercises, he says, exploit gravity. He tells me how to use gravity and resistance to break down a muscle, so it will come back stronger. He shows me how to do a proper, safe bicep curl. He walks me over to a dry erase board and diagrams my muscles, arms, joints, tendons. He talks about a bow and arrow, shows me the pressure points along a bow as it's pulled taut, then uses this model to explain my back, why it hurts after matches and workouts. I tell him about my spine, my spondylolisthesis, the vertebra that's out of sync. He jots a note, says he'll look up the condition in the medical books and learn all about it for me.
Bottom line, he says, if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to have a short career. Big-time back problems, knee problems. Plus, keep doing curls the way I saw you doing them, you're going to have elbow problems.
While spelling it all out, Gil sometimes literally spells it out. He likes to emphasize a point by spelling the key word. He likes to break words down for me, crack them open, reveal the knowledge inside, like the meat inside a nut. Calorie, for instance. He says it comes from the Latin calor, which is a measure of heat. People think calories are bad, Gil says. But calories are just measures of heat, and we need heat. With food, you feed your body's natural furnace. How can that be bad? It's when you eat, how much you eat, the choices you make, that's what makes all the difference. People think eating is bad, he says, but we need to stoke our internal fire. Yes, I think. My internal fire needs stoking. Speaking of heat, Gil mentions casually that he hates the warm weather. He can't bear it. He's unusually sensitive to high temperatures, and his idea of torture is sitting under the direct sun. He turns up the air conditioning. I make a note. I tell him about running with Pat on Rattlesnake Hill, how I feel I've hit a plateau. He asks,
How much do you run every day?
5 miles.
Why?
I don't know.
Have you ever run 5 miles in a match?
No.
How often in a match do you run more than 5 steps in one direction before stopping?
Not very.
I don't know anything about tennis, but it seems to me that, by the 3rd step, you'd better be thinking about stopping. Otherwise, you're going to hit the ball and keep running, which means you'll be out of position for your next shot. The trick is to throttle down, then hit, then slam on the brakes, then hustle back. The way I see it, your sport isn't about running. It's about starting and stopping. You need to focus on building the muscles necessary for starting and stopping.
I laugh and tell him that might be the smartest thing I've ever heard anyone say about tennis. When it's time to lock up for the night, I help Gil clean the gym, turn off the lights. We sit in my car and talk. Eventually, he notices that my teeth are chattering.
Doesn't this fancy car have a heater?
Yes.
Why don't you turn it on?
Because you said you're sensitive to heat. He stammers. He says he can't believe I remembered, and he can't bear to think I've been suffering all this time. He turns up the car heater full blast. We continue talking, and soon I notice that beads of sweat are forming on Gil's brow and upper lip. I turn off the heat and roll down the windows. We talk for another 30 minutes, until he notices that I'm starting to turn blue. He turns the heater on full blast. In this way, back and forth, we talk, and demonstrate our respect for each other, until the early hours of the morning. I tell Gil a little about my story. My father, the dragon, Philly Perry. I tell him about being banished to the Boletari Academy. Then he tells me his story. He talks about growing up outside Las Cruces, New Mexico. His people were farm workers, pecans and cotton. Hard work. Wintertime, pick the pecans. Summertime, cotton. Then they moved to East L.A., and Gil grew up fast on the hard streets.
It was war, he says. I got shot. Still have the bullet hole in my leg. Also, I didn't speak English, only Spanish. So I'd sit in school, self-conscious, not talking. I learned English by reading Jim Murray in the Los Angeles Times and listening to Vin Scully calling Dodger games on the radio. I had a little transistor. KABC, every night. Vin Scully was my English teacher.
After mastering English, Gil decided to master the body God gave him. He says,
Only the strong survive, right? Well, we couldn't afford weights in our neighborhood, so we made our own. Guys who'd been in the joint showed us how. For instance, we filled coffee cans with cement, stuck them on the ends of a pole, and that's how we made a bench press. We used milk crates for the actual bench.
He tells me about getting his black belt in karate. He tells me about some of his 22 professional fights, including one in which he got his jaw shattered.
But I wasn't knocked out, he says proudly.
When it's time to say goodnight, because the sky is growing lighter, I reluctantly shake Gil's hand and tell him I'll be back tomorrow.
I know, he says.
I work with Gil throughout the fall of 1989. The gains are big, and our bond is strong. 18 years older than I, Gil can tell that he's a father figure. On some level, I also sense that I'm the son he never had. He has 3 children, all daughters. It's one of the few things that go unspoken between us. Everything else gets hashed out, spelled out. Gil and his wife, Gay, have a lovely tradition. Thursday nights, everyone in the family can order whatever they want for dinner, and Gay will cook it. One daughter wants hot dogs? Fine. Another wants chocolate chip pancakes? No problem. I make a habit of stopping by Gil's house on Thursdays, eating off everyone's plates. Before long, I'm eating at Gil's every other night. When it's late, when I don't feel like driving home, I crash on his floor. Gil has another tradition. No matter how uncomfortable a person looks, if they're asleep, they can't be all that uncomfortable. You should leave them be. So he never wakes me up. He just throws a light afghan over me and lets me sleep until morning.
Listen, Gil says one day. We love having you here, you know that. But I have to ask, good-looking kid, wealthy kid, kid who can be lots of places, and yet you come to my house for Thursday night hot dogs. You sleep curled on my floor.
I like sleeping on floors. My back feels better.
I'm not talking about the floor. I mean, here. Are you sure you want to be here? You must have better places to be.
Can't think of anywhere else I'd rather be, Gil. He gives me a hug. I thought I knew what a hug was, but you've really never been hugged until you've been hugged by a man with a 56-inch chest. On Christmas Eve, 1989, Gil asks if I'd like to come over to the house, celebrate the holiday with his family. Thought you'd never ask. While Gay bakes cookies, while their daughters are upstairs sleeping, Gil and I sit on the living room floor, putting together toys and train sets from Santa. I tell Gil that I don't know when I felt so peaceful.
Wouldn't you be happier at a party? With friends?
I'm right where I want to be. I stop putting together the toy in my hand and fix Gil with a look. I tell him my life has never for one day belonged to me. My life has always belonged to someone else. First my father, then Nick, and always, always, tennis. Even my body wasn't my own until I met Gil, who is doing the one thing fathers are supposed to do, making me stronger. So being here, Gil, with you and your family, I feel for the first time in my life that I'm where I belong.
Enough said. I'll never ask again. Merry Christmas, son.
Chapter 11. If I must play tennis, the loneliest sport, then I'm sure as hell going to surround myself with as many people as I can off the court, and each person will have his specific role. Perry will help with my disordered thoughts. JP will help with my troubled soul. Nick will help with the basics of my game. Philly will help with details, arrangements, and always have my back. Sports writers rip me about my entourage. They say I travel with all these people because it feeds my ego. They say I need this many people around me because I can't be alone. They're half right. I don't like to be alone. But these people around me aren't an entourage. They're a team. I need them for company, for counsel, and for a kind of rolling education. They're my crew, but also my gurus, my blue ribbon panel. I study them and steal from them. I take an expression from Perry, a story from JP, an attitude or a gesture from Nick. I learn about myself, create myself, through imitation. How else could I do it? I spent my childhood in an isolation chamber, my teen years in a torture chamber. In fact, rather than make my team smaller, I want to grow it. I want to add Gil, formally. I want to hire him, full-time, to help me with my strength and conditioning. I phone Perry at Georgetown and tell him my problem.
What problem? He says. You want to work with Gil? So hire Gil.
But I've got Pat, the spitting Chilean. I can't just fire the guy. I can't fire anyone. And even if I could, how do I then ask Gil to leave a high-profile, high-paying job with UNLV to work exclusively for me? Who the fuck am I?
Perry tells me to have Nick reassign Pat to work with the other tennis players Nick coaches. Then, he says, sit down with Gil and put it to him. Let him decide. In January 1990, I ask Gil if he would do me the great honor of working with me, traveling with me, training me.
Leave my job here at UNLV?
Yes.
But I don't know anything about tennis.
Don't worry, I don't either. He laughs. Gil, I think I can accomplish a lot. I think I can do things. But after our short time together, I'm reasonably certain that I can only do them with your help. He doesn't need a hard sell. Yes, he says. I would like to work with you. He doesn't ask how much I'll pay him. He doesn't mention the word money. He says we're two kindred spirits embarking on a great adventure. He says he's known it almost from the day we met. He says I have a destiny. He says I'm like Lancelot.
Who's that? Sir Lancelot. You know, King Arthur. Knights of the Round Table. Lancelot was Arthur's greatest knight.
Did he kill dragons?
Every knight kills dragons.
There is only one obstacle in our path. Gil doesn't have a gym at his house. He'll need to convert his garage into a full-scale gym, which will take lots of time because he wants to build the weight machines himself.
Build them? I want to weld the metal, make the ropes and pulleys with my own hands. I don't want to leave anything to chance. I won't have you injured. Not on my watch.
I think of my father building his ball machines and blowers, and wonder if this is the one and only thing he and Gil have in common. Until Gil's gym is complete, we continue to work out at UNLV. He keeps his job, works with the Rebels basketball team through a brilliant season, culminating in a blowout win over Duke for the national title. When his duties are done, when his home gym is almost done, Gil says he's ready.
Andre, now are you ready? One last time, are you sure you want to do this?
Gil, I am more sure about this than I've ever been about anything I've ever done.
Me too.
He says he's going to drive to the college this morning and turn in his keys. Hours later, as he walks outside the college, there I am, waiting. He laughs when he sees me, and we go for cheeseburgers to celebrate new beginnings. Sometimes a workout with Gil is actually a conversation. We don't touch a single weight. We sit on the free benches and free associate. There are many ways, Gil says, of getting strong, and sometimes talking is the best way. When he's not teaching me about my body, I'm teaching him about tennis, the life on tour. I tell him about how the game is organized, the circuit of minor tournaments and the four majors, or grand slams, that all players use as yardsticks. I tell him about the tennis calendar, how we start the year on the other side of the world at the Australian Open, and then just chase the sun. Next comes clay season in Europe, which culminates in Paris with the French Open. Then comes June, grass season, and Wimbledon. I stick out my tongue and make a face. Then come the dog days, the hard court season, which concludes with the U.S. Open. Then the indoor season, Stuttgart, Paris, the World Championships. It's all very Groundhog Day. Same venues, same opponents, only the years and scores are different. And over time, the scores all run together like phone numbers. I try to tell Gil about my psyche. I start at the beginning,
the central truth. He laughs.
You don't actually hate tennis, he says.
I do, Gil. I really do. He gets a look on his face, and I wonder if he's thinking he might have quit his job at UNLV too soon.
If that's true, he says, why play?
I'm not suited for anything else. I don't know how to do anything else. Tennis is the only thing I'm qualified for. Also, my father would have a fit if I did anything different. Gil scratches his ear. This is a new one on him. He's known hundreds of athletes, but he's never known one who hated athletics. He doesn't know what to say. I reassure him that there's nothing to be said. I don't understand it myself. I can only tell him how it is. I also tell Gil about the image is everything debacle. I feel, somehow, that he needs to know so he'll understand what he's got himself into. The whole thing still makes me angry, but now the anger has seeped down deep. Hard to talk about, hard to reach. It feels like a spoonful of acid in the pit of my stomach. Hearing about it, Gil feels angry too, but he has less trouble accessing his anger. He wants to act on it, right now. He wants to punch out an advertising exec or two. He says,
some slapdick on Madison Avenue puts together a silly ad campaign and gets you to say a line into a camera, and it means something about you?
Millions of people think so, and say so, and write so.
They took advantage of you, he says. Plain and simple. Not your fault. You didn't know what you were saying. You didn't know how it would be taken and twisted and misinterpreted.
Our talks carry beyond the weight room. We go out for dinner. We go out for breakfast. We're on the phone 6 times a day. I call Gil late one night, and we talk for hours. As the conversation winds down, he says,
do you want to come over tomorrow and get in a workout?
I'd love to, but I'm in Tokyo.
We've been talking for 3 hours and you're in Tokyo? I thought you were across town. I feel guilty, man. I've been keeping you all this...
He stops himself. He says,
you know what? I don't feel guilty. Nah, I feel honored. You needed to talk to me, and it doesn't matter if you're in Tokyo or Timbuktu. I get it. All right, man, I get it.
From the start, Gil keeps a careful record of my workouts. He buys a brown ledger and marks down every rep, every set, every exercise, every day. He records my weight, my diet, my pulse, my travel. In the margins, he draws diagrams and even pictures. He says he wants to chart my progress, compile a database he can refer to in the coming years. He's making a study of me, so he can rebuild me from the ground up. He's like Michelangelo appraising a block of marble, but he's not put off by my flaws. He's like Da Vinci getting it all down in his notebooks. I see in Gil's notebooks, in the care he takes with them, in the way he never skips a day, that I inspire him, and this inspires me. It goes without saying that Gil will travel with me to many tournaments. He needs to watch my conditioning in matches, monitor my food, make sure I'm always hydrated. But not just hydrated. Gil has a special concoction of water, carbs, salt, and electrolytes that I need to drink the night before every match. His training doesn't end on the road. If anything, it becomes more important on the road. Our first trip together, we agree, will be February 1990 to Scottsdale. I tell Gil we'll need to be there a couple of nights before the tournament starts for the hit and giggle.
Hit and what?
It's an exhibition with some celebrities to raise money for charity, to make corporate sponsors feel good, to entertain the fans.
Sounds fun.
What's more, I tell him, we're going to drive over in my new Corvette. I can't wait to show him how fast it goes. But when I pull up to Gil's house, I realize that I might not have thought this all the way through. The car is very small, and Gil is very big. The car is so small that it makes Gil look twice as big. He contorts himself to fit into the passenger side, and even then, he needs to tilt sideways, and even then, his head touches the roof. The Corvette looks as if, at any moment, it might burst apart. Seeing Gil squished and uncomfortable, I'm motivated to go very fast. Of course, I don't need extra motivation in the Corvette. The car is supersonic. We crank the music and fly out of Vegas, across Hoover Dam, down toward the craggy Joshua Tree forests of northwest Arizona. We decide to stop for lunch outside Kingman. The prospect of food, combined with the speed of the Corvette and the loud music and the presence of Gil, makes me mash the gas. We hit Mach 1. I see Gil make a face and twirl a finger. I look in the rearview mirror. A highway patrol car inches from my back fender. The patrolman quickly gives me a speeding ticket. "Not my first," I tell Gil, who shakes his head. In Kingman, we stop at Carl's Jr. and eat an enormous lunch. We both love to eat, and we both have a secret weakness for fast food. So we fall off the nutrition wagon, ordering French fries, then ordering seconds, refilling our sodas. When I squeeze Gil back into the Corvette, I realize we're well behind schedule. We need to make up time. I floor it and zoom back onto US 95, 200 miles to Scottsdale, 2 hours of driving. 20 minutes later, Gil makes the same twirling gesture. A different patrolman this time. He takes my license and registration and asks,
"Have you received a speeding ticket recently?"
I look at Gil. He frowns.
"Well, if you consider an hour ago recent, then yes, officer, I have." "Wait right here."
He walks back to his car. 1 minute later, he returns.
"The judge wants you back in Kingman."
"Kingman? What?"
"Come with me, sir."
"Come with... what about the car?"
"Your friend can drive it."
But can't I just follow you?"
"Sir, you are going to listen to everything I say and do everything I say, and that's why you're not going back to Kingman in handcuffs. You will sit in the back of my car, and your friend will follow us. Now, step out."
I'm in the back of a police car, Gil following in a Corvette that fits him like a whalebone corset. We're in the middle of nowhere, and I'm hearing the crazy-ass plinking banjos from Deliverance. It takes 45 minutes to reach Kingman Municipal Court. I follow the patrolman into a side door and find myself before the small, elderly judge who wears a cowboy hat and a belt buckle the size of a pie tin. The banjos are getting louder. I look around for a certificate on the wall, something to prove that this is, in fact, a courthouse and he's a real judge. All I see are heads of dead animals. The judge begins by rattling off a series of random questions.
"You're playing in Scottsdale?"
"Yes, sir."
"You've played that tournament before?"
Yes, sir."
"What kind of draw do you have?"
"Pardon?"
"Who do you play in the first round?"
The judge, it turns out, is a tennis fan. Also, he's followed my career closely. He thinks I should have beaten Courier at the French Open. He has a slew of opinions about Connors, Lendl, Chang, the state of the game, the scarcity of great American players. After sharing his opinions with me, liberally, for 25 minutes, he asks,
"Would you mind signing something for my kids?"
"No problem, sir, Your Honor." I sign everything he puts before me, then await sentencing.
"All right," the judge says. "I sentence you to go give 'em hell down in Scottsdale."
"Sorry? Your Honor, I drove back here 30-some miles. Sure, I was going to be sent to jail, or at least fined."
"No! No. I just wanted to meet you. But you'd better have your friend out there drive you to Scottsdale. Because one more ticket today, and I will have to keep you in Kingman until the cows come home.
I walk out of the courthouse, but sprint to the Corvette, where Gil is waiting. I tell him the judge is a tennis buff who wanted to meet me. Gil thinks I'm lying. I beg him to please just drive us away from this courthouse. He pulls away, slowly. Under normal circumstances, Gil is a cautious driver, but so unnerved is he by our run-in with Arizona law enforcement that he keeps the car in sixth gear and goes 54 miles per hour all the way to Scottsdale. Naturally, I'm late to the hit and giggle. As we roll into the parking lot of the stadium, I pull on my tennis gear. We stop at the security hut and tell the guard I'm expected. I'm one of the players. He doesn't believe me. I show him my driver's license, which I feel fortunate to still have in my possession. He waves our car through. Gil says,
"Don't worry about the car. I'll take care of it. Just go."
I grab my tennis bag and sprint through the parking lot. Gil tells me later that when I entered the arena, he heard the applause. The windows of the Corvette were rolled up, but he still heard the crowd. In that moment, he had a sense of what I'd been trying to tell him. After the command performance for the Old West judge, after hearing the stadium greet my arrival with a frenzied roar, he understood. He confesses that, until this trip, he didn't realize the life was so insane. He really didn't know what he was signing on for. I tell him, that makes two of us. We have a wonderful time in Scottsdale. We learn about each other fast, the way you learn about people on the road. During one midday match, I halt play and wait for a tournament official to hurry an umbrella over to where Gil is sitting. He's in direct sunlight, perspiring fiercely. When the official hands Gil the umbrella, Gil looks confused. Then he looks down, sees me waving, understands. He flashes a 56-inch smile, and we both laugh. We go to dinner one night at the Village Inn. It's late. We're eating a combo platter of dinner and breakfast. Four guys burst into the restaurant and sit one booth away. They talk and laugh about my hair, my clothes.
"Probably gay,"
one says.
"Definitely homo," says his buddy.
Gil clears his throat, wipes his mouth with a paper napkin, tells me to enjoy the rest of my meal. He's done.
"Aren't you going to eat, Gilly?"
"No, man. The last thing I want during a fight is a full stomach."
When I'm finished, Gil says he has some business to take care of at the next table. If anything happens, he says, I shouldn't worry. He knows the way home. He stands very slowly. He sidles over to the four guys. He leans on their table. The table groans. He fans his chest in their faces and says,
"You enjoy ruining people's meals? That's how you like to spend your time, huh? Gee, I'm going to have to try that myself. What are you having there, hamburger?"
He picks up the man's burger and eats half in one bite.
"Needs ketchup," Gil says, his mouth full. "You know what? Now I'm thirsty. I think I'll take a sip of your soda. Yeah, and then I think I'll spill it all over the table as I set it down. I want one of you to try to stop me."
Gil takes a long sip, then slowly, almost as slowly as he drives, pours the rest of the soda over the table. Not one of the four guys moves. Gil sets down the empty glass and looks at me.
"Andre, are you ready to go?"
I don't win the tournament, but it doesn't matter. I'm content, happy as we start back on the road to Vegas. Before leaving town, we stop for a bite at Joe's main event. We talk about all that's happened in the last 72 hours, and we agree that this trip feels like the start of a bigger trip. In his Da Vinci notebook, Gil draws a picture of me in handcuffs. Outside, we stand in the parking lot and look at the stars. I feel such overwhelming love and gratitude for Gil. I thank him for all he's done, and he tells me I never need to thank him again. Then he gives a speech. Gil, who learned English from newspapers and baseball games, delivers a flowing, lilting, poetic monologue right outside Joe's, and one of the great regrets of my life is that I don't have a tape recorder with me. Still, I remember it nearly word for word. Andre, I won't ever try to change you, because I've never tried to change anybody. If I could change somebody, I'd change myself. But I know I can give you structure and a blueprint to achieve what you want. There's a difference between a plow horse and a racehorse. You don't treat them the same. You hear all this talk about treating people equally, and I'm not sure equal means the same. As far as I'm concerned, you're a racehorse, and I'll treat you accordingly. I'll be firm, but fair. I'll lead, never push. I'm not one of those people who expresses or articulates feelings very well, but from now on, just know this. It's on, man. It is on. You know what I'm saying? We're in a fight, and you can count on me until the last man is standing. Somewhere up there is a star with your name on it. I might not be able to help you find it, but I've got pretty strong shoulders, and you can stand on my shoulders while you're looking for that star. You hear? For as long as you want. Stand on my shoulders and reach, man. Reach. Chapter 12. At the 1990 French Open, I make headlines by wearing pink. It's on the front page of the sports pages, and in some cases, the news pages. Agassi in the pink. Specifically, pink compression pants under acid-washed shorts. I tell reporters, it's not pink. It's technically hot lava. I'm astonished by how much they care. I'm astonished by how much I care that they get it right. But my feeling is, let them write about the color of my shorts rather than the flaws in my character. Gil and Philly and I don't want to deal with the press, the crowds, Paris. We don't enjoy feeling alien, getting lost, having people stare at us because we speak English. So we lock ourselves in my hotel room, turn up the air conditioning, and send out for McDonald's and Burger King. Nick, however, gets a nasty case of cabin fever. He wants to go out, see the sights.
Guys, he says, we're in Paris. Eiffel Tower, the frickin' Louvre. Been there, done that, Philly says.
I don't want to go near the Louvre, and I don't have to. I can close my eyes and see the scary painting of the man hanging from the cliff while his father clutches at his neck and his other loved ones hang from his limbs. I tell Nick, I don't want to see anything or anyone. I just want to win this fucking thing and go home. I march through the early rounds, playing well, and then run into Courier again. He wins the first set in a tiebreak, but falters and gives me the second. I take the third, and then, in the fourth, he curls up and dies, 6-0. His face turns red. His face turns hot lava. I want to tell him, I hope that was enough cardio for you, but I don't. Maybe I'm maturing. Without question, I'm getting stronger. Next up is Chang, the defending champ. I play with a chip on my shoulder because I still can't believe he's won a slam before me. I envy his work ethic, admire his court discipline, but I just don't like the guy. He continues to say without compunction that Christ is on his side of the court, a blend of egotism and religion that chafes me. I beat him in four. In the semis, I play Jonas Svensson. He has a massive serve that kicks like a mule, and he's never afraid to come to the net. He plays better on fast surfaces, however, so I feel good about catching him on the clay. Since he has a big, looping forehand, I decide early that I'm going to bum-rush his backhand. Again and again,
I go to that vulnerable backhand, seizing a quick lead, 5-1. Svensson doesn't recover. Set, Agassi. In the second set, I grab a 4-0 lead. He breaks back to 3-4. That's as close as I let him get. To his credit, he finds a ray of confidence and wins the third set. Normally, I'd be rattled, but this year I look to my box and see Gil. I replay his parking lot speech and win the fourth set, 6-3. I'm in the final at last. My first final at a slam. I'm facing Gomez from Ecuador, whom I just beat weeks ago. He's 30, on the verge of retiring. In fact, I thought he was retired. At last, the newspapers say, Agassi is going to realize his potential. Then, catastrophe strikes. The night before the final, I'm taking a shower and I feel the hairpiece Philly bought me suddenly disintegrate in my hands. I must have used the wrong kind of conditioner. The weave is coming undone. The damned thing is falling apart. In a state of abject panic, I summon Philly to my hotel room. Fucking disaster, I tell him. My hairpiece. Look. He examines it. We'll let it dry, then clip it in place, he says. With what? Bobby pins. He runs all over Paris looking for bobby pins. He can't find any. He phones me and says, what the hell kind of city is this? No bobby pins? In the hotel lobby, he bumps into Chris Evert and asks her for bobby pins. She doesn't have any. She asks why he needs them. He doesn't answer. At last, he finds a friend of our sister Rita who has a bag full of bobby pins. He helps me reconfigure the hairpiece and set it in place and keeps it there with no fewer than 20 bobby pins. Will it hold? I ask. Yeah, just don't move around a lot. We both laugh, darkly. Of course, I could play without my hairpiece, but after months and months of derision, criticism, mockery, I'm too self-conscious. Image is everything? What would they say if they knew I've been wearing a hairpiece all this time? Win or lose, they wouldn't talk about my game. They would only talk about my hair. Instead of a few kids at the Boletari Academy laughing at me, or 12,000 Germans at Davis Cup, the whole world would be laughing. I can close my eyes and almost hear it. And I know I can't take it. Warming up before the match, I pray, not for a win, but for my hairpiece to stay on. Under normal circumstances, playing in my first final of a slam, I'd be tense, but my tenuous hairpiece has me catatonic. Whether or not it's slipping, I imagine that it's slipping. With every lunge, every leap, I picture it landing on the clay, like a hawk my father shot from the sky. I can hear a gasp going up from the crowd. I can picture millions of people suddenly leaning closer to their TVs, turning to each other and in dozens of languages and dialects, saying some version of, did Andre Agassi's hair just fall off? My game plan for Gomez reflects my jangled nerves, my timidity. Knowing he doesn't have young legs, knowing he'll fold in a fifth set, I plan to stretch out the match, orchestrate long rallies, grind him down. As the match begins, however, it's clear that Gomez also knows his age, and thus he's trying to speed everything up. He's playing quick, risky tennis. He wins the first set in a hurry. He loses the second set, but also in a hurry. Now I know that the longest we'll be out here is 3 hours, rather than 4, which means conditioning won't play a role. This is now a shot-making match, the kind Gomez can win. With 2 sets completed and not much time off the clock, I'm facing a guy who's going to be fresh throughout, even if we go 5. Of course, my game plan was fatally flawed from the start. Pathetic, really. It couldn't work, no matter how long the match, because you can't win the final of a slam
by playing not to lose or waiting for your opponent to lose. My attempt to orchestrate long rallies merely emboldens Gomez. He's a veteran who knows this might be his last shot at a slam. The only way to beat him is to take away his belief and his desire by being aggressive. When he sees me playing conservative, orchestrating instead of dominating, it gives him heart. He wins the third set. As the fourth set begins, I realize I've made yet another miscalculation. Most players, when they tire late in a match, lose some zip on their serve. They have trouble getting up high on tired legs, but Gomez has a slingshot serve. He never gets up high on his legs. He leans into the ball. When he tires, therefore, he leans that much more, and his natural slingshot action becomes more pronounced. I've been waiting for his serve to weaken, and instead it's getting sharper. Upon winning the match, Gomez is exceedingly gracious and charming. He weeps. He waves to the cameras. He knows he'll be a national hero in his native Ecuador. I wonder what it's like in Ecuador. Maybe I'll move there. Maybe that's the only place I'll be able to hide from the shame I feel at this moment. I sit in the locker room, head bowed, imagining what the hundreds of columnists and headline writers will say, not to mention my peers. I can hear them now. Image is everything. Agassi is nothing. Mr. Hot Lava is a hot mess. Philly walks in. I see in his eyes that he doesn't just sympathize, he lives it. This was his defeat, too. He aches. Then he says the right thing, striking the right tone, and I know I'll always love him for it.
Let's get the fuck out of this town.
Gil pushes the big trolley with our bags through Charles de Gaulle Airport. I'm walking a step ahead. I stop to look at the arrivals and departures. Gil keeps going. The trolley has a sharp metal edge, and it pushes into my soft, exposed Achilles. I'm wearing loafers with no socks. A jet of my blood spurts onto the glassy floor, then another. The Achilles is gushing. Gil hurries to get a bandage out of his bag, but I tell him to relax, take his time. It's good, I say. It's fitting. There should be a pint of my blood from my Achilles heel on the floor before we leave Paris. I skip Wimbledon again, train hard with Gil all summer. His home garage is finished, filled with a dozen handmade machines and many other unique touches. In the window, he's mounted a massive air conditioner. On the floor, he's nailed a spongy astroturf. And in the corner, he's put an old pool table. We shoot nine ball between reps and sets. Many nights, we're in the gym until 4 a.m, Gil searching for new ways to build up my mind, my confidence, along with my body. He's shaken by the French Open, as am I. One morning, before the sun comes up, he passes along some words his mother always tells him.
Qué lindo es soñar despierto, he says.
How lovely it is to dream while you are awake. Dream while you're awake, Andre. Anybody can dream while they're asleep, but you need to dream all the time and say your dreams out loud and believe in them. In other words, when in the final of a slam, I must dream. I must play to win. I thank him. I give him a gift. It's a necklace with a gold pyramid, and inside the pyramid are three hoops. It represents the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I designed it, had a jeweler in Florida make it for me, and I have an earring that matches. He puts it around his neck, and I can tell it will be a cold day in hell before he takes it off. Gil likes to yell at me when I'm working out, but it's nothing like my father's yelling. Gil yells love. If I'm trying to set a new personal best, if I'm preparing to lift more than I've ever lifted, he stands in the background and yells, "Come on, Andre! Let's go! Big Thunder!"
His yelling makes my heart club against my ribs. Then, for an added dash of inspiration, he'll sometimes tell me to step aside, and he'll lift his personal best, 550 pounds. It's an awesome sight to see a man put that much iron above his chest, and it always makes me think that anything is possible. How beautiful to dream. But dreams, I tell Gil, in one of our quiet moments, are so damned tiring. He laughs.
I can't promise you that you won't be tired, he says. But please know this, there's a lot of good waiting for you on the other side of tired. Get yourself tired, Andre. That's where you're going to know yourself, on the other side of tired.
Under Gil's care and close supervision, I pack on 10 pounds of muscle by August 1990. We go to New York for the U.S. Open, and I feel lean and rangy and dangerous. I take out Andrei Cherkasov from the Soviet Union in an easy three-setter. I punch and scratch my way to the semis, beat Becker in four furious sets, and still have plenty of rocket fuel in my tank. Gil and I drive back to the hotel and watch the other men's semi to see who I'll get tomorrow, McEnroe or Sampras. It doesn't seem possible, but the kid I thought I'd never see again has reconstituted his game, and he's giving McEnroe the fight of his life. Then I realize he's not giving McEnroe a fight. McEnroe is giving him a fight and losing. My opponent tomorrow, incredibly, will be Pete. The camera moves close on Pete's face, and I see he has nothing left. Also, the commentators say his heavily taped feet are covered with blisters. Gil makes me drink Gil water until I'm ready to throw up, and then I go to bed with a smile, thinking about all the fun I'm going to have running Pete's ass off. I'll have him sprinting from side to side, left to right, from San Francisco to Bradenton, until those blisters bleed. I think of my father's old maxim, put a blister on his brain. Calm, fit, cocksure, I sleep like a pile of Gil's dumbbells. In the morning, I feel ready to play a 10-setter. I have no hairpiece issues because I'm not wearing my hairpiece. I'm using a new, low-maintenance camouflaging system that involves a thicker headband and brightly colored highlights. There's simply no way I can lose to Pete, that hapless kid I watched with sympathy last year, that poor klutz who couldn't keep the ball in the court. Then, a different Pete shows up, a Pete who doesn't ever miss. We're playing long points, demanding points, and he's flawless. He's reaching everything, hitting everything, bounding back and forth like a gazelle. He's serving bombs, flying to the net, bringing his game right to me. He's laying wood on my serve. I'm helpless. I'm angry. I'm telling myself, this is not happening. Yes, this is happening. No, this cannot be happening. Then, instead of thinking how I can win, I begin to think of how I can avoid losing. It's the same mistake I made against Gomez, with the same result. When it's all over, I tell reporters that Pete gave me a good old-fashioned New York street mugging. An imperfect metaphor. Yes, I was robbed. Yes, something that belonged to me was taken away. But I can't fill out a police report, and there is no hope of justice, and everyone will blame the victim. Hours later, my eyes fly open. I'm in bed at the hotel. It was all a dream. For a splendid half-second, I believe that I must have fallen asleep on that breezy hill while Philly and Nick were laughing about Pete's ruined game. I dreamed that Pete, of all people, was beating me in the final of a slam. But no, it's real. It happened. I watch the room slowly grow lighter, and my mind and spirit grow palpably darker. Chapter 13.
Ever since Wendy came to watch me film the Image is Everything commercial, she and I have been a couple. She travels with me, takes care of me. We're a perfect match because we grew up together, and we figure we can keep growing up together. We come from the same place, want the same things. We love each other madly, though we agree that ours should be an open relationship. Her word. She says we're too young to make a commitment, too confused. She doesn't know who she is. She grew up Mormon, then decided she didn't believe the tenets of that religion. She went to college, then discovered that it was the completely wrong college for her. Until she knows who she is, she says, she can't give herself to me completely. In 1991, we're in Atlanta with Gil, celebrating my 21st birthday. We're in a bar, a seedy old place in Buckhead, with cigarette-scorched pool tables and plastic beer mugs. The three of us are laughing, drinking, and even Gil, who never touches the stuff, is letting himself get tipsy. To record this night for posterity, Wendy has brought her camcorder. She hands it to me and tells me to film her shooting baskets at one of those tented arcade games. She's going to school me, she says. I film her shooting for 3 seconds and then let the camera pan slowly down her body. Andre, she says, please get the camera off my ass. In comes a mob of loudmouths. Roughly my age, they look like a local football or rugby team. They make several rude remarks about me, then focus their attention on Wendy. They're drunk, crude, trying to embarrass me in front of her. I think of Nastasi doing the same thing 14 years ago. The rugby team slaps a stack of quarters on the edge of our pool table. One of them says, "We got next." They walk off, smirking. Gil puts down his plastic mug, picks up the quarters, and walks slowly to a vending machine. He buys a bag of peanuts and comes back to the table. Slowly, he works his way through the peanuts, never taking his eyes off the rugby players, until they wisely decide to try another bar. Wendy giggles and suggests that, in addition to his many functions and duties, Gil should be my bodyguard. He already is, I tell her, and yet that word doesn't cut it. That word isn't adequate to what he is. Gil guards my body, my head, my game, my heart, my girlfriend. He's the one immovable object in my life. He's my lifeguard. I particularly enjoy when people, reporters, fans, kooks, ask Gil if he's my bodyguard. A smile always plays across his lips as he says, "Touch him and find out." At the 1991 French Open, I batter my way through 6 rounds and reach the final, my third slam final. I'm facing Courier, and I'm favored. Everyone says I'll beat him. I say I'll beat him. I need to beat him. I can't imagine what it would feel like to make 3 slam finals in a row and not win. The good news is, I know how to beat Courier. I beat him just last year at this same tournament. The bad news is, it's personal, which makes me tight. We began in the same place, in the same barracks at the Bolotari Academy, our bunk beds a few feet apart. I was so much better than Courier, so much more favored by Nick, that losing to him in the final of a slam will feel like the hare losing to the tortoise. Bad enough that Chang has won a slam before me, and Pete, but Courier too? I can't let that happen. I come out playing to win. I've learned from my mistakes at the last 2 slams. I cruise through the first set, winning 6-3, and in the second set, leading 3-1, I have break point. If I win this point, I'll have a chokehold on the set and match. Suddenly, the rain starts to fall. Fans cover themselves and run for shelter. Courier and I retreat to the locker room, where we both pace like caged lions. Nick comes in, and I look to him for advice, encouragement, but he says nothing. Nothing. I've known for some time that I continue with Nick out of habit and loyalty, and not for any real coaching.
Still, in this moment, it's not coaching I need, but a show of humanity, which is one of the duties of any coach. I need some recognition of the adrenaline-charged moment in which I find myself. Is that too much to ask? After the rain delay, Courier stations himself farther behind the baseline, hoping to take some of the steam off my shots. He's had time to rest and reflect and recharge, and he storms back to keep me from breaking, then wins the second set. Now I'm angry, furious. I win the third set 6-2. I establish in Courier's mind and in my own that the second set was a fluke. Up 2-1, I can feel the finish line pulling me. My first slam, 6 little games away. As the fourth set opens, I lose 12 of the first 13 points. Am I unraveling, or is Courier playing better? I don't know. I'll never know. But I do know that this feeling is familiar, hauntingly familiar. This sense of inevitability, this weightlessness as momentum slips away. Courier wins the set 6-1. In the fifth set, tied 4-4, he breaks me. Now, all at once, I just want to lose. I can't explain it any other way. In the fourth set, I lost the will, but now I've lost the desire. As certain as I felt about victory at the start of this match, that's how certain I am now of defeat. And I want it. I long for it. I say under my breath, let it be fast. Since losing is death, I'd rather it be fast than slow. I no longer hear the crowd. I no longer hear my own thoughts, only a white noise between my ears. I can't hear or feel anything except my desire to lose. I drop the 10th and decisive game of the fifth set and congratulate Courier. Friends tell me it's the most desolate look they've ever seen on my face. Afterward, I don't scold myself. I coolly explain it to myself this way. You don't have what it takes to get over the line. You just quit on yourself. You need to quit this game. The loss leaves a scar. Wendy says she can almost see it, a mark as if I've been struck by lightning. That's about all she says on the long flight back to Vegas. As we walk through the front door of my parents' house, my father meets us in the foyer. He starts right in on me.
Why didn't you make adjustments after the rain delay? Why didn't you hit to his backhand?
I don't answer. I don't move. I've been expecting his tirade for the last 24 hours, and I'm already numb to it. But Wendy isn't. She does something no one's ever done, something I always hoped my mother would do. She throws herself between us. She says, "Can we just not talk about tennis for 2 hours? 2 hours, no tennis?" My father stops, gapes. I fear that he'll slap her. But then he wheels and storms up the hall to his bedroom. I gaze at Wendy. I've never loved her more. I don't touch my rackets. I don't open my tennis bag. I don't train with Gil. I lie around watching horror movies with Wendy. Only horror movies can distract me because they capture something of the feeling in that fifth set against Courier. Nick nags me to play Wimbledon. I laugh in his tanned face.
"Back on the horse," he says. "It's the only way, my boy." "Fuck that horse."
"Come on," Wendy says. "Honestly, how much worse can it get?" Too depressed to argue, I let Nick and Wendy push me onto a plane to London. We rent a beautiful 2-story house hidden from the main road, close to the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club. It has a charming garden in the back, with pink roses and every variety of songbird, a little haven where I can sit and nearly forget why I'm in England. Wendy makes the house feel like home. She fills it with candles, groceries, and her perfume. She fixes delicious meals at night, and in the morning she packs box lunches for me to bring to the practice courts. The tournament is delayed 5 days by rain. On the fifth day, though the house is cozy, we're going stir crazy. I want to get out on the court. I want to get rid of the bad taste in my mouth from the French Open, or else lose and go home. Finally, the rain lets up. I play Grant Connell, a serve and volleyer who's made his living off fast surfaces. It's an awkward first-round opponent for my first grass match in years. He's expected to trounce me. Somehow, I eke out a 5-set win. I reach the quarters, where I play David Wheaton. I'm up 2 sets to 1, up 2 breaks in the 4th set, and all of a sudden, I pull something in my hip flexor, the muscle that bends the joint. Hobbled, it's all I can do to finish the match. Wheaton wins easily. I tell Wendy that I could have won the thing. I started to feel better than I'd felt at the French Open. Damned hip. The good news, I suppose, is that I wanted to win. Maybe I've got my desire turned around and pointed in the right direction. I'm a fast healer. After a few days, my hip is fine. My mind, however, continues to throb. I go to the U.S. Open and lose in the first round. The first round. But the scary part is the way I lose. I play Krikstein, good old Krikstein, and again, I just don't want it. I know I can beat him, and yet, it's not worth the trouble. I don't expend the necessary energy. I feel a strange clarity about my lack of effort. It's lack of inspiration, plain and simple. I don't question it. I don't bother wishing it away. While Krikstein is running and leaping and lunging, I'm watching him with only mild interest. Only afterward does the shame set in. I need to do something radical, something to break the seductive grip that losing seems to have on me. I decide to move out on my own. I buy myself a 3-bedroom tract home in Southwest Vegas and turn it into the ultimate bachelor pad, almost a parody of a bachelor pad. I make 1-bedroom an arcade with all the classic games, Asteroids, Space Invaders, Defender. I'm terrible at them, but I intend to get better. I turn the formal living room into a movie theater with state-of-the-art sound equipment and woofers in the couches. I turn the dining room into a billiard room. Throughout the house, I scatter fantastically plush leather chairs, except in the main living room, where I install a massive, modular, green chenille, double-stuffed, goose-down couch. In the kitchen, I place a soda machine stocked with Mountain Dew, my favorite, and beer taps. Out back, I install a hot tub and a black-bottomed lagoon. Best of all, I make the bedroom a cave, everything jet black, with blackout curtains that don't admit the tiniest slit of daylight. It's the house of an arrested adolescent, a boy man determined to shut out the world. I walk around this new house, this deluxe playpen, daring to think how grown up I am. I skip the Australian Open again at the start of 1992. I've never played it, and now it doesn't seem like the time to start. Still, I play the Davis Cup and do fairly well, maybe because it's in Hawaii. We face Argentina. I win both my matches. Then, the night before the last day, Wendy and I go out drinking with McEnroe and his wife, Tatum O'Neill. We overdo it, and I go to bed at 4 in the morning, assuming someone will take my place on Sunday in a meaningless match, often called a dead rubber. Apparently, that's not the case. Though I'm hungover and dehydrated, I need to go out and play Haite, whose serve I once caught with my hand. Happily, Haite's hungover too. It's fitting that this is a dead rubber. We both look dead and rubbery. To conceal my bloodshot eyes, I play wearing Oakley sunglasses, and somehow I play well. I play relaxed. I walk off the court a winner, wondering if there's a lesson in this. Can I tap this sort of relaxation when the stakes are real, when it's a slam? Should I just go into every match hungover? The next week, I find myself on the cover of Tennis Magazine, hitting a winner in my Oakley sunglasses. Hours after the magazine hits the newsstands, Wendy and I are at the bachelor pad when a delivery truck pulls up to the door. We go outside.
"Sign here," the delivery man says. "What is this?" "Gift. From Jim Jannard, founder of Oakley."
The back of the truck comes down, and a red Dodge Viper slowly descends. Nice to know that, even if I've lost my game, I can still move product. My ranking plummets. I fall out of the top 10. The only time I feel fairly competent on the court is when I play Davis Cup. In Fort Myers, I help the U.S. beat Czechoslovakia, winning both matches. Otherwise, the only game at which I show any improvement is Asteroids. At the 1992 French Open, I beat Pete, which feels good. Then I run into Courier again, this time in the semis. The memories of last year are still fresh, still painful, and I lose again, in straight sets. Once again, Courier laces up his running shoes and goes for a jog afterward. I still can't burn enough calories for him. I limp to Florida and crash at Nick's house. I don't pick up a racket the whole time I'm there. Then, reluctantly, I have one short practice on a hard court at the Bolitari Academy, and we all fly to Wimbledon. The talent assembled in London in 1992 is stunning. There's Courier, ranked number one, fresh off two slam victories. There's Pete, who keeps getting better. There's Stefan Edberg, who's playing out of his mind. I'm the 12th seed, and the way I've been playing, I should be seeded lower. In my first round match, against Andrei Chesnokov from Russia, I play like a low seed. I lose the first set. Frustrated, I rip into myself, curse myself, and the umpire gives me an official warning for saying fuck. I almost turn to him and fire a few fuck, fuck, fucks. Instead, I decide to shock him, shock everyone, by taking a breath and being composed. Then I do something more shocking. I win the next three sets. I'm in the quarters, against Becker, who's reached six of the last seven Wimbledon finals. This is his de facto home court, his honey hole. But I've been seeing his serve well lately. I win in five sets, played over 2 days. Memories of Munich put to rest. In the semis, I face McEnroe, three-time Wimbledon champion. He's 33, nearing the end of his career, and unseeded. Given his underdog status and his legendary accomplishments, the fans want him to win, of course. Part of me wants him to win also, but I beat him in three sets. I'm in the final. I'm expecting to face Pete, but he loses his semifinal match to Goran Ivanisevic, a big, strong serving machine from Croatia. I've played Ivanisevic twice before, and both times he's shellacked me in straight sets. So I feel for Pete, and I know I'll be joining him soon. I have no chance against Ivanisevic. It's a middleweight versus a heavyweight. The only suspense is whether it will be a knockout or a TKO. As powerful as Ivanisevic's serve is under normal circumstances, today it's a work of art. He's acing me left and right, monster serves that the speed gun clocks at 138 miles an hour. But it's not just the speed, it's the trajectory. They land at a 75-degree angle. I try not to care. I tell myself that aces happen. Each time he serves a ball past me, I say under my breath that he can't do that every time. Just walk to the other side and get ready, Andre. The match will be decided on those few second serves. He wins the first set 7-6. I don't break him once. I concentrate on not overreacting, on breathing in, breathing out, remaining patient. When the thought crosses my mind that I'm on the verge of losing my fourth slam final, I casually set that thought aside. In the second set, Ivan Isevich gives me a few freebies, makes a few mistakes, and I break him. I take the second set, then the third, which makes me feel almost worse, because once again I'm a set away from a slam. Ivan Isevich rises up in the fourth set and destroys me. I've made the Croat mad. He loses only a handful of points in the process. Here we go again. I can see tomorrow's headlines as plain as the racket in my hand. As the fifth set begins, I run in place to get the blood flowing and tell myself one thing. You want this. You do not want to lose. Not this time. The problem in the last three slams was that you didn't want them enough, and therefore you didn't bring it. But this one you want. So this time, you need to let Ivan Isevich and everyone else in this joint know you want it. At 3-3, I'm serving, break point. I haven't been able to make a first serve this entire set, but now, mercifully, I make one. He returns it to the center of the court. I hit to his backhand. He hits a chip lob. I have to back up two steps. The overhead is one of the easiest shots you can play. It's also the epitome of my struggles at slams, because it's too easy. I don't like things too easy. It's there for the taking. Will I take it? I swing, hit a textbook overhead, and win the point. I go on to hold serve. Now Ivan Isevich is serving at 4-5. He double faults. Twice. He's down love 30. He's cracking under the strain. I haven't broken this guy in the last hour and a half, and now he's breaking himself. He misses another first serve. He's coming apart. I know it. I see it. No one knows better than I what coming apart looks like. I also know how it feels. I know precisely what's happening inside Ivan Isevich's body. His throat is closing. His legs are quivering. But then he quiets his body and hits a second serve to the back of the box, a beam of yellow light that barely nicks the line. A puff of chalk shoots up as if he hit the line with an assault rifle. Then he hits another unreturnable serve. Suddenly, it's 30 all. He misses another first serve, makes the second. I crush a return, he hits a half volley, I run in and pass him and start the long walk back to the baseline. I tell myself, you can win this thing with one swing. One swing. You've never been this close. You may never be again. And that's the problem. What if I get this close and don't win? The ridicule. The condemnation.